Well, I'm supposed to talk to you about dating, sex, and marriage. Fun. A couple of years ago, three TV shows dominated the ratings. Bachelorette, Jill Millionaire, and Married by America. Remember those? All three were reality shows, all three dealt with dating, and all three raised very important questions. And I think each one of those shows raised a single question that is absolutely decisive to wrestle with at your stage of life and at mine. But I'm going to tailor this specifically for right where you're at now in life. And here are the three questions. How does sex fit into a dating relationship? Because it does. Second, how do you discover who you're going to marry? And third, how should you even think about marriage at this point in your life? Those three questions, and it'll be a day. Let's dig in. Starting with sex in the dating game. Here's how it played out with The Bachelorette. A 29-year-old pediatric physical therapist who moonlights as a dancer for the NBA's Miami Heat starts off with 25 men. And in just a matter of weeks, through a series of romantic dinners and hot tub rendezvous and passionate kisses and overnight trysts in candle-filled fantasy suites, whittles them down rose by rose until she finds the man of her dreams to marry. And sex was a part of it all the way. When Trista finally selected Ryan on the way, 15 men had been selected out of a group of 25. Of those 15, she became instantly physical on the first set of group dates with two of them. When she then went on several individual dates, she was physical with all of them, kissing, cuddling, hot tubs, and that was before the cameras had to cut off. By the fifth episode, she was sleeping with at least two of them, if not three. Now, what was the idea? The idea is that sex is just part of the selection process, part of the vetting, just the natural course of things. It's just the way you play the dating game. You sleep with whoever you're dating. I mean, why not? Everywhere you look, sex is no big deal. It's just something that people do who are attracted to each other, and they do it fairly quickly, early on in the relationship. No need to wait. In fact, right now, one of the most popular things happening in many college campuses is just hooking up. You don't even have to hardly know their name, just kind of get together, and that's the whole purpose of the first date. And the way it's talked about and the way it's portrayed, it's always fun. It's always right. It's always exciting. As long as you make sure nobody gets pregnant, I mean, that would complicate things, and you're protected against sexually transmitted diseases, you've covered your bases. Now, is that reality? No. At least not according to the Bible. Now, before you tune out on that one, you should know some things that isn't often talked about. And the first thing is that the Bible thinks sex is absolutely terrific. It teaches that God created our sexuality, that sex was part of the design for our bodies and our lives. In the opening chapters of the Bible, we have the clearest statement imaginable that God made Adam, a man, to sexually want and desire and need a woman, Eve. And it wasn't just emotionally, it was physically. They were to become one flesh. Don't ever forget that sex was God's idea and God's design and God's creation. And that's not all the Bible tells us. It goes out of its way to note in the creation narrative that they were both naked and felt no shame. And that wasn't just because they both had just finished Atkins. Under God's design, sex was something good. It wasn't dirty or cheap or sordid or immoral. It was meant as a gift. In fact, in one of the most overlooked books in the Bible, the Song of Songs, you find this beautiful, even erotic love poem between a man and a wife. But sex wasn't just a gift for pleasure. It was also a gift for intimacy. And the Bible tells us that God designed sex to do something to the people who engaged in it. In 1 Corinthians, the Apostle Paul writes that there is more to sex than skin on skin, that sex is as much spiritual mystery as it is physical fact. He said the two become one through the act. Now, take note of that, because that's not talked about very often, but it's one of the most important truths about human sexuality. No other human activity has the same power as sexual intimacy. It's the supreme expression of a relationship. It's ultimate emotional unity. Through sex, you can draw nearer to another person in ways that you cannot through any other union. Which is why, if you've ever wondered, sex is to take place within the context of a marriage. And in that context alone, and the Bible isn't fuzzy on this. In the book of Hebrews, it says, honor marriage. Guard the sacredness of the sexual intimacy, because God draws a firm line against casual and illicit sex. You see, God designed sex to be that which is given to another person, shared with another person, something that is a part of the deepest nature of community and intimacy. And when sex is divorced from that, when it becomes recreational or separate from commitment, lifelong commitment within the context of a marriage, something that's more romance, it stops being wonderful. In fact, it becomes destructive. And when people say, oh, yeah, how is it destructive? Well, you know, this needs to be spelled out. Let me give you three ways sex before marriage in a dating relationship or any kind of relationship can be destructive to your life. The first way is that since sex was designed by God to foster intimacy and the two really become one, it needs the safety and the boundaries of marriage to protect us from being wounded deeply. Because apart from the commitment of marriage, sex can become more violation than union. I read of one guy who had been in numerous sexual relationships, and he wrote, I feel like I've left little bits of myself all over the place. And he had. In 1 Corinthians, the Bible says, don't pursue the kind of sex that avoids commitment and intimacy. Why? It leaves us more lonely than ever. It's the kind of sex that can never become one with the other. You just can't walk away from sex unchanged. You see, sex, by its very definition, is giving away the essence of who you are to another person. It is not just a one-night stand. It isn't something which has no significance. It isn't just a physical act. You have entered into oneness. It has been marked by heaven. It is a spiritual reality. It has happened. And the separation of the one back into two always will rip apart your soul. And you may not know it now, you may not feel it now. It will rip through your life. Second, it is a direct offense against God. Let's just say that. It has spiritual repercussions. Going against God's sexual design separates you from intimacy with Him. You cannot violate what He has outlined sexually and be intimate with Him. You can't. If you think you are, you're kidding yourself. You're not intimate with Him. Going against God's sexual design separates you. It tears away at your soul. It drives God away. Let me just read to you how Eugene Peterson paraphrased 1 Corinthians 6, 18 and 19 on this. In the Message, it says, there is a sense in which sexual sins are different from all others. In sexual sins, we violate the sacredness of our own bodies, these bodies that were made for God-given and God-modeled love, for becoming one with another. Or didn't you realize that your body is a sacred place, the place of the Holy Spirit? Well, a final danger is that sex is relational. I mean, sex outside of marriage overwhelms the relationship. Physical intimacy becomes a substitute for emotional intimacy. Electricity and stimulation gets confused with love and commitment. And the sexual intimacy will dominate, which more often means that the infrastructure for a lasting relationship will not be built. So, how do you play the dating game? Particularly if you want to do it with integrity and purpose. If it's not about sex and romance, and it shouldn't be about sex, what is it about? Well, all of us, young, old, male, female, who find ourselves in a situation where we're in the dating game, we need to ground ourselves about what dating is ultimately trying to achieve. It's not ultimately trying to achieve sex. Most of us are wanting a relationship. That's the Holy Grail. So what is it that brings about a solid, lasting relationship? Well, Now it's time to move on to the second show, Joe Millionaire. Remember how that one started? 20 women in horse-drawn carriages arrived at a French chateau to meet a man who they were told was a newly rich Prince Charming. Now, I know some of you remember how it ended because it was the number one watched program on Fox TV's history at that point in time. Almost 35 million tuned in. The only problem is that everybody found out that Evan Marriott was a construction worker who made $19,000 a year, not a winner. Which raises the question, is there really a Mr. Right out there? Or is it all illusion? And if there is a Mr. or Miss Right out there, how do you know what makes them right? The Bible gives an interesting spin on this one. You know, the Bible teaches that God really does have a will for our lives, a plan that he would very much like us to follow that would bring about maximum meaning and joy. And that will includes relationships. Let me tell you something. God really does have someone in mind for you, someone who is perfect for you. So who is it? What is God's will for your relational life? How do you find the perfect mate God has in mind for you, and what is it that makes him perfect for you? Well, it's not that he's tall, dark, handsome, and rich. It's not that she's beautiful and bright and can cook. Here it is. If you're a Christian, it's that the other person is a Christian. That's God's choice for your perfect mate. That's the guidance. That's the perfect one God has for you and what makes them perfect. In 2 Corinthians, the Bible says, don't team up with those who are unbelievers. How can a believer partner up, be married, join in intimacy, become one with an unbeliever? Now, let's talk about that one for a minute. That was not meant to put people down who don't share the Christian faith. It wasn't meant to arbitrarily limit your playing field. It was meant to protect you from mismatches and the pain and the division and the separation that can come from that mismatch. And there's no greater mismatch than a spiritual mismatch, because it's the highest, deepest level of intimacy that two people can possibly share. Your most important connection with someone is not physical. It's not intellectual. It's not even emotional. The deepest part of who you are is spiritual, which means that the most intimate thing you have to offer, the most intimate thing you have to share, the most intimate thing you have to build a relationship on is spiritual. It's your soul. And only when you and whoever you're relating to on that level, only when you do that spiritually do you open the door to the greatest levels of intimacy, which means that the journey toward full and complete intimacy with someone that results in marriage, it's a spiritual journey. It's a spiritual journey. That's how the two become one. It's how Christ can be part of a marriage. If Christ isn't present in both lives, he can't join you together. He can't be the tie that binds. Now, please, don't make this something superficial or trivial, like whether they're a Republican or a Democrat, they like football or enjoy the outdoors. This is the most important reality of someone's life. So if you go to God and say, who should I marry? Who is Mr. Right? Who is Miss Right? God's going to say, it's someone who knows me the way you do. It's someone who loves me the way you do. That's the perfect mate. That's what you look for. Now, once you've got that down, I believe it's up to you. What's key is spiritual compatibility. Once that's in place, there could be any number of people you could share your life with. Doesn't mean there's a lot of fun stories out there about people being uniquely meant for each other and circumstances that seem to throw two people together. You know, providence is always a doctrine best seen in hindsight. But I don't think that's the norm. I don't think that's the norm. And it shouldn't be what you're waiting for or looking for. You see, we all want God's will to be specifically laid out like a map. 9 times out of 10, God doesn't give you a map. He gives you a compass. If you're following true north, then there's all kinds of paths you can take, which means you're free to look at things like chemistry and attraction and economic backgrounds and educational experiences and families of origin. There's all kinds of things that go into a successful match, not the least of which is that you both are making a lifelong commitment to make the relationship work once you're married. But make no mistake, get the headline. What makes someone foundationally right for you is spiritual. Now, let me drive that one home a bit. Because it's one thing to say, of course I'm going to marry a Christian, and then actually doing it, particularly if you're a woman. So dial in on this one with me. I'm going to go and take a bit of a risk in exploring this, but I do so out of great conviction because I'm just seeing it too much and I'm starting to just get mad. Too many hearts are being broken and too many dreams are being torn. So guys, eavesdrop while I talk to the women. A woman finds herself attracted to a man and he pursues her. And there is nothing more intoxicating, more alluring to many women than being pursued. Nothing is greater than that. Couple that with a deep desire for love and companionship, marriage and family, and you have instant vulnerability. But she knows enough to check him out spiritually, and of course, he passes the non-Satanist, haven't worshiped the devil, of course I believe in God test. So she asks about church, and it starts to get a bit fuzzy, but no worry. She asks if he would be willing to go to church with her, and he says, sure. I mean, in his mind, cheap date. And not only that, it's part of the pursuit. But that's what she doesn't see, that it's part of the pursuit. I mean, he's after her. The church thing, the God talk, it's like sending roses and candy. It's like putting candles on the dinner table. It's like straightening up the apartment or the dorm room before she comes over. He's in hot pursuit. The God stuff is just part of what it takes. It's part of the game. And so she buys it. And she starts to open up her heart to the relationship. Then a strange thing happens. The more she gets to know him, the more she sees that he's not really a spiritual guy at all. In fact, he's probably never really given his life to Christ as leader. I mean, he believes. I mean, it's America. That's like saying you don't like baseball or you're a communist. But only in the most general cultural sense. In terms of Christ being a deep driving factor in his life, in terms of coming to Christ as leader and forgiver, in terms of him being a spiritual leader of the relationship, it's just not there. And she's starting to see it. But she buries it. She doesn't let it come into full view. Every now and then it concerns her, but it's too late. She's given her heart. And emotions overrule the head. Now, about this time, what some women do is they start the evangelistic dating routine. She starts buying him books, linking him with Christian friends, giving him tapes. She's on a mission to transform him. Now that she sees what he's not and never was, but she's romantically involved, she tells herself, makeover. Right? And because he plays along, she thinks she's covered. She feels she's got the spiritual base all taken care of. Because everything else is so right. Then comes the question, will you marry me? She's already said yes 1,000 times in her heart. But she goes for the spiritual prenuptial agreement. Will you go to church with me? Will you pray with me? Will you read the Bible with me? Will we raise our children this way? Will Christ be in this? Now, what do you think he's going to say? Is he going to say, are you kidding? You think all the wine and roses, candles and dinners, dates and church is going to go on? Babe, once I get you down the aisle, it is Budweiser and pizza, mowing the lawn and cable TV, football and sleeping in on Sunday. You think that's what he's going to say? He's going to say, absolutely, I want God in our relationship too. But he's just after the deal. And once he gets it, he's done. Now hear me on this. This is not a bad guy. He's not out to purposely deceive. His heart is in this one too. He will do anything, say anything, give anything to win the girl. But that's what it's about for so many guys. Winning, competition, achieving the goal. It's just how we're wired up. But when the deal is done, the aisle is walked, that's when reality kicks in because romance fades. And you realize that connecting spiritually was everything. And you realize that you're going to be waking up every day to someone who can never share the deepest parts of who you are You can never grow together in places that matter most. You can never talk about the most important things, which are spiritual, the soul, the very heart of what it means to be a son or daughter of the living God. And suddenly, Mr. Perfect isn't. And he never was. Because what makes someone perfect wasn't there to begin with. The deepest, most important part of the relationship was missing from day one. So don't open yourself up emotionally to someone who you know from the outside is not God's person for you. He's already spoken. I wonder if this one is the right one. Are they a Christ follower? Well, no, it's not God's will. It's not. Someone who is not God's person for you, if they're a spiritual mismatch. So let me ask you the tough question. Why are you even dating? Why are you even dating? Why are you running the risk of opening up your heart? Why are you making yourself vulnerable to something that should never be? You shouldn't. Be friends all day long. Keep it there. Don't set yourself up. Don't even start the dating process. And if you already have, and they're telling you everything you want to hear, oh, be so careful. And if you were really close to me, and I could talk to you as a father, like I do to my daughters, I would say, break it off. Break it off. If they come to faith later, naturally, on their own, yay, God! But now, don't even run the risk. Don't even run the risk. Which brings us to one last show. Married by America. 5 singles, 2 men, 3 women were picked to play. Their friends and family picked 5 potential fiancés, which they then whittled down to 2. Then America voted one by one for who they were to marry. The first time the couple saw each other was when the guys proposed. All 5 gals said yes. So then it was off to a ranch to live together for 5 weeks. And week by week, relationship experts eliminated the couple least likely to make it, moving toward the one couple that would be married by America. The couple that made it got a luxury car, check for $100,000, and if they went through with the wedding, a new home. Sound good? Well, if you think marriage is about emotion and beauty contests, sexual compatibility and romance, maybe. If it's about playing house, sharing meals and rent, this approach might be as good as any other. If marriage is something you just try on for size and then decide whether to keep, then the Fox Network may have really been onto something. But what if that's not the reality about marriage? And see, that's the problem. It isn't. And this is the final thought I want to leave you with. In our day, we make marriage all about what we get out of it, not what we are creating with it, and in the end, giving our lives to making work. Let me put it to you this way. If I were to say to you, listen, remember, if you contemplate marriage, it's all about love, you'd say, of course. But what if I were to say, listen, remember, if you contemplate marriage, it's all about death to self and sacrifice, you'd say, excuse me? That's not why I'm getting married. I'm getting married to get, not give, to be served, not serve. See, that's the breakdown. The truth is that love, when it's authentic, is not about us. It's not about us. Marriage, when it's real, when it's right, when it's being that foundational institution, when it's reflecting Christ in his relationship with us, when it is being honored, is always sacrificial. It's loving and being loved, serving and being served, knowing and being known, celebrating and being celebrated, which means it involves the death of self. Which is why in Ephesians, the Bible says, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church. How did Christ love the church? He died. He died for. See, today it's all about personal fulfillment. I mean, do you hear how we talk? The man of my dreams. The person who will make me happy. The love of my life. The person who will meet my needs. That's not marriage. That's not love. That's why Married by America isn't real. Neither is The Bachelorette, neither is Joe Millionaire, but I can give you a story that is. It comes from the life of a man named Robertson McQuilkin and his wife, Muriel. It was during a vacation in Florida when he saw the first sign physically in her life. Muriel repeated a story that she had told 5 minutes earlier to some friends they were visiting. And then it began to happen more and more frequently. And then 3 years later, when she was in the hospital for testing, a doctor pulled Robertson aside and told him that he may need to think about the possibility that his wife had Alzheimer's. I mean, he couldn't believe it. He didn't want to believe it. But then her memory deteriorated even further. They went to a neurologist, and after a battery of tests, confirmed that she had the disease. Her loss of memory turned into an inability to even continue a train of thought. Soon she couldn't read. She couldn't write. She never even knew what was happening to her. Where once there was this vibrant, creative, articulate human being, there was now this process like a slow death, this light that was dimming out, a fade from life itself. And so McQuilkin soon found himself torn between these two commitments, two divine callings, the growing needs of his wife and the demands of his career. So he made the decision to approach the Board of Trustees at Columbia with the need for them to find a successor, that there was quickly coming a day when Muriel would need him full time, and he wanted her to have him. He was 57 years old at the time, and it seemed unlikely that he could hold out until he could retire naturally at 65. They didn't want to act on his request. They made no plans, and while he appreciated their response, he knew that was not realistic, and he knew it wasn't responsible, which led to years of struggle of what should be sacrificed, his role as president, or the caring of his wife. You know, his trusted, most lifelong friends urged him to stay at the presidency, urged him to stay at Columbia, that institutionalizing his wife was the best course, that his wife would grow accustomed to that environment. But all he could think of was whether anyone would love her there, let alone love her as he did. He had often seen the empty, lifeless faces of those people lined up in wheelchairs along the corridors of bare hallways, waiting for the fleeting visit of a loved one. For a while, he arranged for a companion to stay with him in her home so he could go to the office every day. She lost, by this time, all of her comprehension. She couldn't express hardly any of her thoughts. Yet when he would leave, she would take out after him, trying to follow him wherever he would go. Sometimes she would take out after him as many as 10 times a day. Sometimes at night, when he helped her undress to go to bed, he would find her with bloody feet. And so he told the doctor about it, and the eyes just filled with tears in the doctor's face. And he said, "You don't know what's going on, but I can tell you, she has such love for you. That's why she's doing it." He says, "What do you mean?" And he said, "The characteristics come out at this time. Her heart so longed to be with him, to be near him, that all she could do, even in her lack of comprehension, was just try to follow him." But being with her wasn't easy. When they went to the grocery store, she would begin to load other people's carts and take off with them. She would refuse to eat. She would refuse to take a bath. He was used to meeting multi-million dollar budgets and designing programs to grasp emerging global opportunities. None were as demanding as this. And so the tension built. Full-time president, Columbia. Full-time caring for his wife. And his wife's deteriorating condition made the moment of decision draw ever near. Again, his friends circled around him. They said, "You are at your peak of influence. Your peak of impact as president. You can't do anything else for your wife." Well, the time finally came. He had to decide. And decide he did. He resigned as president of Columbia. And I want you to hear what he said when he did. It was never intended to be public. It was never meant to be some kind of show. None of this even came to light until a few years ago. But we have just under 2 minutes recorded almost accidentally of what he said to the students and to the Board of Trustees. And I can't think of a better way to end our time together than by listening and watching it together. So let's do that now.
I haven't in my life experienced easy decision-making on major decisions, but one of the simplest and clearest decisions I've had to make is this one, because circumstances dictated it. Muriel, now, in the last couple of months, seems to be almost happy when with me, and almost never happy when not with me. In fact, she seems to feel trapped, becomes very fearful, sometimes almost terror. And when she can't get to me, there can be anger. She's in distress. But when I'm with her, she's happy and contented. And so I must be with her at all times. And you see, it's not only that I promised in sickness and in health, till death do us part, and I'm a man of my word. But as I have said, I don't know with this group, but I've said publicly, it's the only fair thing. She sacrificed for me for 4 years to make my life possible. So, if I cared for her for 40 years, I'd still be in debt. However, there's much more. It's not that I have to, it's that I get to. I love her very dearly, and you can tell it's not easy to talk about. She's a delight. It's a great honor to care for such a wonderful person.